grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively. Newcomers, is there anybody here in your first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you by first name. Anybody here first 30 days? All right. On Zoom, you can raise your hand. Somebody will chat with you. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask those present to please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism by taking AA's simple actions. The AA preamble says, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So the format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. And tonight we are on step one, part two. Last week we did the doctor's opinion, the allergy. Tonight the readings are more focused around the obsession of the mind. Please help me welcome our panel tonight. We have John and Ben. So I'll read the first paragraph on page five, and then the panel will share for a few minutes on each reading, and that's what we're going to do. So step one says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Page five, I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw that I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time, I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then. And I did. John's going to kick us off tonight.
Well, hey, everybody, I'm John. I'm an alcoholic, and my sobriety date is September 3rd, 2021. I have a home group. I have a sponsor. He knows he's my sponsor. I do have service obligations that I gladly fulfill. I do have the opportunity to sponsor another man. I say all that to just get it out of the way because I'll forget if I don't. I've been looking forward to this since I moved to Norfolk, so I'm kind of excited, especially with David Francis and Ben by my side to do this. You know, my drinking, I never really had any high resolve to quit. Once I started, I was off to the races. I mean, I was 15 and I loved it. And I loved it so much, I got alcohol poisoning. And then the next day, I couldn't wait to do it again and again and again and again and again. To so much to the point that when it came time to graduate high school and move out to college, the only thing I had concerned of, how can I get as far away from anybody I'm related to that could tell on me as possible? And with most of my family at East Carolina, I had gotten early accepted to East Carolina and Appalachian. So by October of my senior year, I had taken Appalachian State because that was going to be 6 hours from pretty much anybody. Even living in Winston-Salem, that was 2 hours away. So that's where mom and dad were. Everybody else was over in Greenville, Beargrass, Colerain, Ahoskie, those areas. I'm from, you know, northeastern North Carolina. That's home. So I never cared to quit. I'd made all those mistakes. I had, you know, gone through all the bad relationships, failed so many classes, gotten fired, done all those things. And for 20 years, I never really thought twice, because even when I did on the worst of days, I was like, well, there's one thing that'll make me feel better. And that's another beer or another drink, another night out. So when it says being, you know, I could laugh at the gin mills, I was still inside of those places. I mean, I couldn't wait to get back into them. I couldn't wait to get back into drinking. There was never a time where I was like, damn, I'm surprised by this, because I there were many a mornings where I'd looked in the mirror and just said, this is who I am. I'm going to be an alcoholic. I knew what alcoholics were. I knew what the disease was. I did not realize that it truly was a disease. I just thought I had it. I had a moral problem. I had a will problem. I couldn't control myself. And I was, the only time I felt in control is when I was out of control. And that was by far, you know, that was the chaos and the insanity was at the very beginning, was just staring right into it, saying, this is who I am. And if you're going to be friends with me, you're going to drink like me. And so I would look to surround myself with people who not only drank like me, but drank a little bit more, so that I looked responsible. That was the funny part. When it came to drinking and driving around, for, you know, from the time that I was 21 and on, I did look the most responsible because I didn't have a DUI yet. And then I collected those like they were baseball cards. And even in the insanity of that, I said, well, at least I didn't hurt anybody. I never thought once of the repercussions of how easily that the next one, how worse it could have been. So it was never about quitting for me. It was always about how can I spin this to make it sound like I was actually in control. So, and with that, I mean, I reckon I'm going to pass for that section.
Thank you, John.
Hey, everybody, I'm Ben, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Ben.
Let's see. Thanks for you guys for asking me to come. This is my first time speaking in AA, and I'm glad to be here. My sobriety date is November 17th, 2021. I do have a sponsor. He knows for sure that he is my sponsor. He knows. And I am on several service committees, or one service committee and several other positions. My home group is downtown Young and Sober, which I'm glad is my home group, because it's got many great, loving people in it. And I have the privilege to be able to sponsor several people in the program, which I never thought I would do. I'm glad to be up here speaking with John. Me and him were just talking about this earlier. We like work well off each other. We're on some of the same committees. So it's great to be able to be up here and do this for the first time with someone I'm close with in the program. For me, it's a little bit different. I grew up around the program. She's like my greatest aspiration to do these things, because she taught me about AA when I was a kid. And as I came in the program, it was funny, like hearing some of the things that were said, I was like, holy shit, this is stuff I grew up hearing. I just didn't know what it was, you know? And like I had role models in this area. I can name them. They don't care. Some of them are here and some are still. Bill Ackerman. He was someone I used to know really well in the program. Dean Martin, he's more of the Ocean View area, and my stepfather Donnett. I had the mental obsession for me was definitely there, but I always had those things from growing up in the program to watch it, you know, because my mom was like, you know, like you could have this, it is a disease, you know, it is something that could happen to you. And I think the severity of my alcoholism, it got bad, but it didn't get as bad as it could have gotten. Just because I had those warning signs. I know for me, like a mental obsession, my spiritual malady, I never thought, even though I grew up around this, I always thought I had it. I know whenever I tried to quit drinking, the first time I tried before I even thought I had some kind of issue, it was just like my wife at the time, her family's Catholic and they were doing Lent. And I was like, oh, you know, let me try not drink for 3 months. Getting through that 3 months was hard. I didn't realize like how much I relied on alcohol to get me through a lot of things. And then like just going on willpower alone, it was very hard. I just didn't understand, you know, like I did because my mom, but I didn't because I'd never tried to do anything about it. And I mean, there's a lot of clarity. Like I started college right around that time. Matter of fact, it was funny as I went to my college orientation. And then that night was like the night that I could start drinking again. So I went to my friend's birthday party and I brought him like 2 12-packs. I drank one of those 12-packs and then then drove to take someone home, came back, and then had a cake too. So like, you know, went in doing all the great things, beer pong, all that you can think of, you know what I'm saying? And then waking his parents up and hearing them, I gotta get up for work in the morning, you know, all the great things you do in as a young adult. And the next time before that was like, I actually felt like I had an issue and I stopped drinking for 6 months. And the one thing I noticed when it comes to the obsession is like, just because we have an obsession with alcohol, it that crosses over into your life too. Cause you don't just have the obsession with alcohol. You like just about anything you can do because of alcoholism makes you obsessed. And the one thing besides trying to use my own willpower, I think that kept me going for those 6 months was the fact that I decided I was going to work 3 jobs because I wanted to make money. I needed to support, you know, my ex-wife who was going to school and just want to make sure our bills are paid. I think that was like the most fulfilled I'd ever felt in my life without drinking. And like somehow I was able to get through that. And then things got good. And I saw that there's this maple flavored beer that came out. And I was like, man, I'm doing good. Like I could have one of these. It's maple flavored. Oh man. And it tasted so good, but it didn't take long for me to start getting back to the point where I was having like hangovers every day and having like DTs while I'm sitting at work and like all these other things. And then like somehow I maintained having 3 jobs and doing that. I don't know how the hell I did that. And I still had to watch my niece on Sundays, taking her out to get like Mickey Mouse pancakes in the morning, feeling hungover shit. And like, yeah, you know what I'm saying? I was a shit-faced alcoholic, but I was still able to be there for my niece somehow. I don't know, man. It's like that mental obsession, you know? It's just there. You know, you don't think it's there, especially even if you have those warnings, but it's still there. It can carry over into your, even in sobriety. I'm going to kind of ramble at this point, so I'm going to stop and let David take over again. Thanks for letting me share.
All right. Thank you both. A rip and start. Thank you. All right. We're going to continue on page 7. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly, even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. John?
That last bit right there, self-knowledge, that always cracks me up because this is, he's talking about, you know, his experience after his brother-in-law, the physician, and the kindness of his mother placed in a nationally known hospital for mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. I didn't have self-knowledge all my drinking career. I thought it was a moral issue. I thought I was a bad person. I thought I didn't have willpower. That was the problem, because every morning when I got thirsty at 4 a.m., I'd go to the fridge to grab a bottle of water and it would be a beer magically. And I just thought I was just perplexed. You know, I was doomed to live this life of an alcoholic. And then I get to rehab. And the first thing that beat into you is that this is a disease. It's not that you're a bad person. You're a sick person. You're not a bad person trying to become good. You're a sick person trying to get better. And they spend, you know, those first 3 days, you're on a whole bunch of medications. Cause I needed medically, medically helped detox. I had to get through it because when I did stop, there was one time, I take that back. I lied to you. Counting my lies. I lied to you. I did try to quit one time, and it was at my uncle's funeral. He was also an alcoholic, but he got sober. He died sober. But I decided that was my warning sign. I was going to quit cold turkey, and I did. I went 3 days without drinking. On the third day, I had a grandma-type seizure at his funeral, walking to his gravesite on the third day. That was a high sign and a very low point, that I woke up with all my parents and aunts and uncles. Everybody was around me in the hospital when they should have been burying my uncle. And with the whole promise that I wasn't going to be like that. I wasn't going to have to go to rehab. I wasn't going to have to be that guy getting better, because he went to WICCACON. And that was an option, because I knew that there were options out there. I knew AA existed. My aunt and my cousin, I have plenty of family to know that this is truly a disease. I just thought, like I said, it was a willpower problem. It was a moral problem. But I knew with that knowledge, the only self-knowledge I truly had was that if I stopped, I would die. So when it came time to go to rehab, I had to go to one of those places that would medically help me through the detox so that I wouldn't have another seizure, so that my mom wouldn't be crying next to a hospital bed or possibly dead. You know, that was also an option. I could have died. So the self-knowledge that they talk about in the book, I wasn't exposed to until rehab. So that kind of opened my eyes to, okay, now I'm sober. What am I going to do with it? Do I stay there in Greensboro? Do I move back to Edenton? Do I take the opportunity to move up here to Norfolk? The only thing that I do know that this sobriety thing was mine to screw up. I literally had to take that self-knowledge of, okay, what they're feeding me are these suggestions on how to live sober. Cause that was the whole reason I went to rehab, was to learn how to live sober. I had to learn how to shower sober, how to, you know, use bathroom, fish, watch football, everything, drive, everything you can think of. I had to learn how to do sober. Unfortunately, I still don't have a license. So we'll tackle that one after I've got this whole, you know, a couple more 24 hours under me, but I think we got a pretty good shot. But I really did. I didn't know how I was going to do anything sober. I just knew it was mine to screw up. But I never knew about this, what was actually in the big book, until about, you know, a week into rehab. Everything else that I knew of Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew from movies, television shows, what my aunt's experience was, 13th stepping with her sponsor. So I really did think that y'all were all just sleeping together and then talking shit about each other. And that's what AA was, that you sit around in a circle, drink coffee, smoke cigarettes, and cry. And then you all leave and you sleep with each other and then you talk crap about each other. That was my experience of self-knowledge. And, luckily I was wrong. And luckily also what they did in rehab is this was the tail end of COVID. So we did have speaker meetings every night, where people with experience would come in and they would tell us about their self-knowledge and how they screwed it up. And that was my first experience with our research department, which is very nice. It always reminds me that it's no better out there. It's not gotten any better. In fact, it gets worse a lot quicker. So that was lesson number one, and keep your seat because you've earned it. But it had to be there. I had to break down the insanity of it, because otherwise I would have treated rehab as a 28-day vacation and either stayed there in Greensboro or moved back to Edenton, living on a boat in a marina and, you know, running a restaurant for the next 20 years, somehow staying sober. So the self-knowledge that we talk about in the rooms, it has to be smashed. That alone, knowing that you're an alcoholic, will not keep you from that next drink. It won't keep you from a white chip. It won't keep you from a tombstone or a hospital bed or a jail cell. And that's if I did have to hold on to any self-knowledge about this program, it has to be that I am an alcoholic, and knowing that isn't going to keep me sober. With that all happened.
Again, I'm Ben.
Hey, Ben.
So self-knowledge and obsession. So it took me a really long time to admit I was an alcoholic. I think what set me on my downward spiral, which also now that I think about it, realize like just because I'm sober, you know, from the alcohol doesn't mean that I can't get addicted and obsessed with other things, was my mom dying. 5 years ago, as of a couple of days ago, she passed away. And like, that was one of my first notices of like how like my alcoholism was so rampant that like I couldn't be there for my sister. See, like it was a situation where I'd always lived out of the house. When my mom passed away, my sister had never lived out of the house. She never moved away. She had only been in college for a couple of years. You know what I mean? And I like mentally checked out. My drinking spiked. It even got so bad to the point I was living in Newport News and working in Chesapeake. And at some point when we were cleaning her house, my mom was so like dedicated to not wanting to be under the influence of anything that she didn't take any of the pain pills they gave her. So when I was going through cleaning up her house, I found a whole bottle of hydrocodone, man. And so morning, noon, on the way home, I was popping a couple of those. And then on the way home and on the way to work, I was stopping at 7-Eleven and getting like those little small, like four packs of the Stutter Home wines, and like downing a couple of those. Mind you, those going from Newport News to Chesapeake, I did this for about 3 weeks. And like, I was just numbing myself, like, you know, just going crazy. And, you know, I didn't think there's anything wrong. Like, you know, and like, that's how unmanageable it got. And it got so crazy for me that like, you know, I became obsessed with like wanting to hurt those that had hurt her, which included my father, my stepfather, and my mom's last boyfriend. See, now this is where the insanity goes. So I was started making like a list of them and started thinking of ways I could take them out. And this is where I always tell people I got really suicidal and homicidal in my, like when I was in, you know, active. I would, you know, I was had that list, and my mom's, her last boyfriend, he had died before, like almost a year before she did. So that was off. I didn't have to worry about that. My dad was in Alabama, so I couldn't get a hold of him. You know, that was going to happen later. But my stepfather was over here in Norfolk. So there was one night where I had been drinking, and I remember I had fell asleep, but I woke up because I was thinking about it. I was like, so easily, I'm not going to go into details because I can play for people. I've talked about some other people and gets kind of graphic the way I thought about doing these things. But I knew that he was over in Norfolk and it would only take me about maybe 30 minutes to get over here. And I got up and I got in my car, and I tell this two different ways because I can't remember. I either got to like the entrance of the apartment complex I lived in, or I got down the road near the exit to where to get on the highway. And I don't know, something made me stop because I had full intentions on going over to where he lived at, breaking into his house and choking him to death and watch the life leave his body. Because for some reason, along with drinking all the time, I thought that that would make me happy again. And I thought that that would like satisfy my need to like, I don't know, for some reason, I thought that that would make the ease go away. You know what I mean? Of just all the pain I'd felt, when in reality, what it was is I'd just always been uncomfortable with myself just as of who I am. Mm-hmm. And I've never felt like that towards anyone else, is just those individuals, because I knew they hurt my mom. But that's just part of it, you know. Along the way, you know, it took a couple years later till I finally decided that I was done. Before I came to the program, I ruined my marriage. I ran through savings, you know what I mean, like my work ethic had gone downhill. I was figuring out how any way possible imagine you could think of to fuck off at work. Actually, it's pretty impressive if you think about it. The ability to be able to go into a warehouse and stack cardboard boxes up and figure out how to lean on a thing like this and just go to sleep. And it was fucking awesome, but I digress. I don't know. It's just like, you know, throughout that whole time though, the obsession of drinking never did stop. Like I would make up any reason to clean the house. I would be like, I'm not going to drink. I'll just go on ahead and like, you know, this would be an 8-hour process for me. And I'd start at like 8 o'clock in the morning. I'd be like, I'll wait till later to drink. Then 10 o'clock would roll around and be like, I can just have one and have that one. And they'll just keep going. By like 3 o'clock, I'm fucking shit faced, but somehow still managed to get the house clean. And I don't know. It's just a long drawn out process of just making myself more and more miserable. Cause you know, and just thinking I need to keep doing this, just keep drinking, just keep taking this drink. You'll feel fine. But it never did anything for me. It just made things worse. It made me more suicidal and made me just like down myself. You know, just talk about, look at myself in the mirror and just, I would constantly tell myself, what a shit person are you? You can do nothing for no one. You're ruining your life. And I don't know, man, it just got bad. I just didn't have any self-confidence to care anything about myself. I'm rambling now, so I'm going to cut it off at that.
All right.
Thank you, Ben.
We'll continue on page 24. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow even taking a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. John?
All right. Now, this is where it gets kind of funny, because this mental obsession, I just told you guys that none of my experience with any of this stuff or exposure to any of this stuff was until rehab. So that means that I was going through these things sober. So that's really fun. I never really cared about humiliation. I never really cared about any suffering that happened about me or people around me while I was drinking. But going through everything in my amends, so my fourth, fifth, you know, eighth, ninth, all that kind of stuff, that was a lot of fun. I had to admit that I was there in the room when I was doing those things, and I was consciously doing them. Those were a lot of conversations that were uncomfortable, but had to be done to be able to sit here with my child, to be able to face every day. But as far as the obsession, knowing that, what about that one beer? Today I can do it. Today I can have a drink. It's been almost 2 years. I've done this and that. I've shown that I can be a good boy. Maybe I can go out and have a beer. That happens. That shit. I was just on a boat a couple hours ago with my nephew. The water was slick. The sun was out. I mean, it was feeling right. You know what would have made it better? An ice cold beer. I don't have the mental obsession to think about it all day long, but man, if it didn't pop in my head for a second, I was like, that would really fuck up today. That would be perfect. And that happens to me. Not, I can't say, you know, I won't be one of those that'll say, oh, it never happens, or I won't say that it doesn't happen, you know, more than I'd like to admit. where that's the old insanity that says you're not really an alcoholic. It hasn't really. I remember calling my aunt one time and my sponsor and some friends and said, you know, this really hasn't been a struggle. I hear all these guys talking about their first 90 days is a struggle. Their first 8 months is a struggle. They're not their first year. Now there were days where it was a struggle, but I was feeling really good about myself one day. And I called my sponsor and I said that I was like, it doesn't really feel like a struggle. He said, well, you're, first of all, you're lying to me. And second of all, if you're following these suggestions, it shouldn't be a struggle. And then my aunt said the same thing. And some of my friends in the program, they said the same thing. And I said, holy shit, for once I'm actually listening to people around me and I'm doing a couple of simple actions and I am doing well and it's not a struggle. But that's what makes the insanity worse, is that if you do well, here comes that little voice in the back of my head that says, you're doing well, have a drink, you're not an alcoholic. Then I have to remind myself that, hey, dude, you got two DUIs in one day. You drove to a car accident at 4:30 in the morning because you thought it was a good idea to talk to the cops like you were going to save your girlfriend at the time. That's what you got you to rehab because you couldn't stop drinking for 3 days on your own because it would have killed you. And then you drove back to the scene of the crime, got in your car to drive to the store because you knew you only had a six pack in the fridge. You're an alcoholic, dude. There's no question about it. My seat was earned multiple times over the course of 20 years. But that doesn't stop that little voice in my head that says, man, it's been more than 10 minutes. It's been a good couple, 24 hours. You've done it, man. You've gone through the steps. Let's celebrate, because it'll do it. And that's what we're talking about here, is that mental obsession, that disease of the mind that really truly will show it. And it does it when you don't expect it. It'll always sneak up on you. It has a way of showing up on a bright, sunny day when the water's slick. It'll show up when you're sitting around the family, the same family that you screwed over so many times, that was crying, disappointed in you, disowned you. My sister didn't want to talk to me at one point because I was still drinking so badly. And then I'll be on a boat with her down in Ocracoke. Now I'll think that, oh man, the sun's just right. I could really screw this up with a couple of beers. As they're drinking, I'm like, I'm one of them. I could do it. So you have to watch yourself. And I, the only times that when it does get really squirrely, the only things that'll help me out is either calling a couple of drunks or taking 10 seconds out of the day to pray. With that, I'll pass.
Thanks, John.
Finnegan. That was good, man. Getting lost. So it's weird, man. It's because, like, when I think, like I said, because of growing up in this program, I somehow was able to keep myself from really lashing out at a lot of people, even though, like, the worst of it when I was at my worst was lashing out at people. That's how it kind of started to turn into itself, because I would, you know, get angry because I would keep everything in. I wouldn't talk about my feelings. I wouldn't talk about what's going on with me. And this is also what made me have those suicidal thoughts and want to kill myself and want to take my anger out on the people that harmed my mother. I somehow was able to keep it in, and I would only, like, it only came out, like, really a lot on my wife, man. And somehow, coming into the program, I've been able to mend the relationship we have because, you know, I want to be able to see my niece. But the obsessing over alcohol and everything when I was still very active was, you know, doing things like buying cheap whiskey bottles, like little pints, and drinking most of them and leaving just enough for if I need to get that little nip, you know, to keep me going, like hiding it in places like in the holes that my cat was scratching underneath the box springs on our beds or like underneath the couch. I would do things like that, you know? And like, I think one of the funniest things I ever did was, so my wife had these like bottles of wine and this little kind of like, not like a little wine holder, and it was sitting on the shelf, and you couldn't really see the top of the bottles from where it was sitting at. So I would wedge it out, pull out a bottle of wine, and somehow be able to pull the cork out and then like pour a little out into a glass and then shove it back in there. And I did this, like emptied all those bottles like three different times. And like just kept doing that, and I would hide it. And like, you know, I would sit there. I even figured out, it was funny. She'd sit there, she had like a little Peloton app, and she'd hop on a bike and do a workout. And the way our living room was set up, there was just enough space to where I could get to the liquor cabinet without her seeing me. And I could grab like whatever liquor was there, and I could go and pour some into a glass and like mix it with soda, and then like sneak back and stick it back in. and like fucking just go and just like take drinks while I'm like cooking dinner and shit. And she's just, I'm sitting there like, how the fuck am I this sneaky that she's not noticing me? She's like right over there just working out. And man, she'd always just look at me. She's like, you've been drinking? I'm like, no, I'm not drinking. Like, what do you mean? You saw me the whole time. I'm just sitting here cooking. Like, eventually she figured it out. You know what I mean? She'd be like, why do you drink alone? Why do you drink alone? I'd be like, I don't know. I had a hard day. You know, I didn't want to admit I had that problem. I was just obsessed with it, you know? Oh, and speaking of with the wine bottles, it was, this is the insanity. So this would be like wine bottles she would get from like four different stores, right? Or bottles of wine. And I replaced them twice. And I'd go on this epic adventure, like, I guess days after I would finish the last one. And I'd go to these different stores when she wasn't around. And I'd go get these and replace them. The last time I'd forgot to, because it was getting towards the end before I finally realized I had to stop. And I had 8 months dry sobriety before I came in the program. And it was funny as shit, because like about 6 months later, she had never touched these things. She went back and looked and found them. And she's like, wanted to get some wine. And she's looking and she's seeing like the cork is like all fucked up, you know, and been like cut bad with like a fucking knife. And she's like, she's looking at it like, what? And she's like pulling up and seeing it's empty. And she's like, did you do this? And I was like, oh shit. It's like, yeah, I did. And then she goes and pulls the whole rack out and sees all these like raggedy corks sticking at the top of these bottles and like fucking seeing it all empty. And she was like, when did you do this? And I was like, a while ago. I didn't mention the fact that this has been the third time I'd done that. You know what I mean? It's a little stupid. I don't know. I feel like those are like more, I can laugh at it now because they're just hilarious, the insanity of it. No, that's like, you know, you do things like that. And then the mental obsession, like, one big thing, even in sobriety, I came into the program, the ex said that she wanted a divorce. And something that I realized I've become really obsessive with too is like wanting to be with other people. When we got together, dating apps weren't a thing, man. I was very codependent. And I thought it was a good idea to hop on Tinder because I'd never done it. Oh boy, you want to talk about a shit show that Tinder is. And also, if you guys didn't know, Facebook has a dating app. It's hidden in the app. You got to actually look for it. There's some people on there, man. Yo, that's a whole thing. And that was a whole learning experience too. Like, no, you can be obsessed. Like, you know, who knew you could be obsessed with trying to go on dates with people and then that'd be a whole toxic thing and then realize how toxic you are. And that's another great thing for character defects. You start learning a lot about yourself. Then thank God I got that out of the way fucking early. Cause now I'm kind of just like in a good place where I'm just like, you know what? Let's let things happen naturally. But I know this is kind of going off topic, but still, it's that whole thing of obsession of the mind. It doesn't just go to alcohol. It goes to every other thing. Like, it could just go on and on about anything. And it's like, after you get done with that obsession, or not get done with it, but like when you turn it over to something positive, it's trying to turn, I like to call it taking that obsession you have and turning it into some kind of positive chaos. Whether it be you get a little bit deep into work or you become of service. And you try to go and just do things better or be there for people. You know what I mean? That's the biggest thing is like, because you have that obsessive mind. It's not just, you know, alcohol was always the cure to a self problem that I had, you know, and that obsessive mind of wanting to just have some peace and everything like that. You got to learn how to quiet that and be in the present. And nowadays it's about trying to find some kind of positive and peaceful way to do that. And fortunately, we had this program that teaches us that there's a lot of positive thing. Keep yourself from wanting to go back. Or even when you have those thoughts of like, oh, I can drink again. No, fuck that shit, man. It's got to be completely smashed. You cannot go back. It's easier now. I can be around a lot of people that are drinking and not really have to worry about it so much anymore. But that doesn't mean that it still doesn't come by every now and then. Like when I see like whiskey Jack Daniels commercials on YouTube, man, you want to talk about some mouthwatering action. That shit happens, man. I can remember one day I could literally feel my mouth salivating like I was going to be like a dog just drooling over everything. And that shit scared the fuck out of me. And I think I called somebody after that just to talk about it, to try to get out of self. But I'm rambling again, so I'm going to stop. I'll let John take back over.
Right on.
Right on. All right, we're going to continue on page 30. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics.
Yeah.
No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned we had to fully conceive to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently may be has to be. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better.
Now we're talking my language. Now we're talking the great obsessions and the gates of insanity. Because this, now that we're not talking about trying to stop, we're talking about trying to control. That was everything that I wanted. I never wanted to be sober, but I never wanted to be the most drunk person in the room. I wanted to be in between. I wanted to be the best DD, that meant drunk driver, you would ever met. I could control myself. I remember this is one thing that I did do about 3 years before rehab. I had gone out with some buddies and we were drinking Jaeger bombs. And then somebody broke out some scotch, some really good scotch, some old scotch. It was older than me. And anyhow, I showed such an ass of myself to my best friend, my girlfriend, and a lot of people that I cared very much about, that I promised them that I would never touch booze again. I told all the bartenders in Edenton, no matter what I say, no matter what I do, never serve me liquor ever again. And they wouldn't. They literally, I never touched liquor again. But I doubled down on my beer. I mean, I would drink 18 beers to go out to the bar to then pick up more beer to get me through till the next morning. So, next morning, including the few hours before I could make it back out to the beer store to get more beer to start the cycle over again. I mean, when I say I was drinking at all times of the day, I was drinking at all times of the day, even sometimes at work. So this, my idea of control was just making sure I didn't fall down. If I made it to my bed, or even not my bed, but if I could make sure that I didn't have to call too many people to apologize the next day, then I called it a good night. And that was my form of control, was controlling that chaos. And I knew that, you know, knowing that you have this disease of a bad, you know, a moral issue and a will problem, blah, 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 all the things that I thought before rehab, and knowing that I was going to die an alcoholic death, you'd think that would make you slow down, but it doesn't. That's just another form of surrender, which I always thought was funny at rehab when we talked about these things. We said, I can't surrender. That shows weakness. Well, you already have. You've surrendered to alcohol. And it's not that you gave things away or you lost. It's not that you lost things because of alcohol. You gave those things away. You know, you gave away the relationships with your family. You gave away those jobs. You gave away those opportunities because you prioritized alcohol over everything. And that's where the disease and everything. We can talk semantics forever. But that illusion of control, that idea that I could be like somebody, I could be like normal people ever again, that illusion has to be completely smashed, like it says, because I'll never be like my dad. I'll never be able to stand behind a grill and drink two beers. I'll never be able to get on the boat and just have a few. You know, those things are long gone. And in fact, the funny thing is when I was in rehab, or in the very early stages of all this, I didn't hear I could never drink again. I heard that I didn't have to drink again, which was two very different things. Because there was a point towards the end that I was sick of it. And I remember the last beer that I had. Well, nope, that was about to be lie number two. One of the last beers that I had was actually sitting with my mom. And it was actually the second time that I tried to quit drinking, which changed which rehab I went to, because I did try to stop drinking again. And I made it till about lunchtime and I started feeling like I was going to have a seizure again. So not only did it not take 3 days to happen again, it took about 6 hours from waking up till about lunchtime that I felt a seizure coming on and I had to crack a beer. And you want to talk about desperate. When you're drinking a beer crying because you know you have to, because you're either going to go to the hospital and die or your mother's going to watch you have another seizure. That's where you're desperate. So I wanted, at that point on, not only did I change rehabs, know I had to go into a medically induced detox or whatever, but I was having a conversation with my mother about, I don't want to be like this. And I couldn't wait to not have to drink to get through the day. So when they told me that I didn't have to, that it was in this book, that they had not only a 28-day program, but then a 2-month stay afterwards, I was like, sign me up. I'm going to stay in that sober living house on campus. You're going to hold my hand to IOP and I'm going to listen to every fucking word you have to say because I don't want to have to drink again. And through all that, the delusion was smashed any idea that I'll ever be normal again was taken from me. And thank God, with all the rest of it, so was the obsession and that compulsion to have to drink to get through the day. Stop there.
So for me, the obsession at this point, as far as trying to quit. So like I said before, I had 8 months of dry sobriety before I came in. I have a best friend who he definitely suffers from alcoholism. He's dry. Somehow I feel with AA, I always feel like there's like 85% of us that definitely need it. And there's like 15% somehow that can manage to do it without it. It's probably going to make some people mad if it does talk to your sponsor, but that's just my personal opinion. And I only say it because of my friend, you know, it was funny is between me and him, in life, there's a lot of things I did that he thought were miraculous. And I was like his inspiration, you know what I'm saying? Like to get on in life. I don't know how, like, I was always kind of like, do you look at me for his inspiration? Holy shit. Okay. I don't know if it's working for you, but, but him seeing him quit on his own and make himself productive. He did it through taking psychedelics and he had a spiritual experience with God and all these other things. Yeah. I mean, that's just, you know, it worked for him. And so far he's doing fine, you know, but maybe one day he'll need this program. But that was my inspiration to try to eventually quit, along with thinking about my mom. And it's funny. Yeah, I know. But hey, that's him, man. He's doing his thing. But so I started trying to use my willpower to slow down. Mind you, throughout this, I'm still feeling very suicidal. And I can remember the last night that I drank, November 16th to 2021, my plans were I was leaving work from Yorktown, go back to Williamsburg, and there's a Total Wine over off Jefferson in a little shopping center there. And I knew that there are these like really high content beers that I knew, like a six pack was like almost $20. They're really high in content. I can't remember how much, but you know, it was enough that I was like, all right, I can drink two of these every day for the next 2 days and I'll be fine. And I'd had a little bit of a good track record recently because I had been slowing down a little bit. So I go, it was a Wednesday. I remember it was a Wednesday. I go and get these things and I'm like sitting there cleaning the house, cooking dinner, like just drinking one. And I'm like, good, I'm good. And then like, I just kept like, you know, I was like in the flavor, I was feeling really good. And I kept like fucking drinking them. But then as time went on, those bad thoughts are coming in of how I feel like I'm a piece of shit because I can't stop. Mm-hmm. And eventually got to the point where like, I used to like hide my like beer bottles like in the bottom of the trash, or like I'd go take them out to the trash can outside so my wife wouldn't see, you know. And these I just wasn't giving a fuck anymore. I was, as time was going on, I was getting down on myself. I'm sitting here feeling these suicidal thoughts and I was just like hating myself and I just didn't want to feel them anymore, but I couldn't stop drinking them. Just keep drinking them. And then like I eventually had like two more left and I went and took them and I hid them in the laundry and I walked upstairs and I'm sitting there like by myself, just all in my head, just chugging these things back, folding laundry. It's weird, man. I was a semi-productive alcoholic. I could get some shit done terribly and off balance, but I could somewhat do it. So I'm sitting here folding laundry and I finish and I'm like chugging down this last beer and I'm just like feeling like it's like I really want to end it. I don't want to do it anymore. I'm done. But I was like, didn't want to die. Like I wanted to, but I didn't want to. So I laid in my bed and I'm like crying. And I called the suicide hotline because I felt like I needed to talk to someone. And someone answered and I hung up. And I called back again. Someone answered and I hung up because I still didn't want to talk. Like I did, but I didn't. And then she comes upstairs yelling because she found the beer bottles. And she saw the two that I had upstairs. And she was like, that's it. I can't do this anymore. You keep doing this over and over again. And it's just making things for us worse. Like, I can't be with you anymore if you're going to keep doing this. And, you know, like at that point it was desperation. I was like, that's it. I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to like make you hate me. I don't want to hurt you anymore. And I stopped like on a little bit of self-will. November 16th, I stopped. Surprisingly, November 17th, I wasn't hungover. And my thought was that if I'm going to have a sobriety date, I'm going to make it whatever day I'm not hungover. Surprisingly, even though I chugged down this whole six pack, I wasn't hungover, which I thought to be the case. I got actually somewhat good sleep, I guess. I don't know. So the next day, that was it. But those feelings of suicidal thoughts and still hating myself were there. And they continued for another 6 months, actually. we thought it'd be a good idea to adopt the dog because that would save a marriage, right? You know what I'm saying? Not the fact that like I'm running through my savings, not the fact that I have all these harebrained schemes of trying to sell domain names for the internet, thinking that that's going to make me some money, or like trying to invest in Bitcoin. I was about 10 years too late on that shit. Yeah. All these things, you know, these things you think you can do to save things, you know what I'm saying? Like the alcoholism was still there. You know, the obsession of trying to fix things using my own will. I remember even talking to my sister after I was like 2 weeks without drinking. And she was like, are you going to go to AA? I was like, no, I got this. I got this. I can do this. My whole big reason for not wanting to come into the program is because I always heard people say you need to change your people, places, and things. I didn't want to change my people because I love my friends. Luckily, before I came to the program, I realized that I didn't need to do that because they're all supportive of me. A lot of them didn't know what I was going through, except for my best friend. Well, he didn't know until we adopted this dog. He ran out and I'm looking at like for, this is like a whole like 8 days. We were walking around for like 8 hours a day in the woods of Williamsburg trying to find this dog. And like my wife's projecting on me, she's like, I hate you, that's it, we're done. And at that, I was at wit's end at that point, you know what I mean? Like somehow I didn't feel like I wanted to drink, but I'm still like just white knuckling, you know. And I called my best friend, the same one I mentioned a few minutes ago. He comes up from Norfolk and he comes to help me look for this dog. And I eventually just laid it out on the table for him. I was like, dude, like I want to kill myself, I'm done, like I can't do this no more. And I had this whole harebrained scheme that like I was gonna like figure out how to kill myself and leave notes and try to hide it, because I knew if I died, then like insurance at work would kick in. My wife and my sister would get like $200,000 a piece. Mm-hmm. And I was going to like go and write these notes out in like binary code and ones and zeros and type it all out. And I was going to find this little timestamp from a movie that explained how you go and you can to figure out how to convert this on a website on the internet. I had a whole plan and I already started like writing one out. And luckily this thing had happened with a dog getting out. And my friend coming, I just told him, and he's like, he looks at me, he's like, how fucking stupid and selfish are you? I was like, what? I'm telling you this because I need your help. I'm trying to vent. He's like, no, you realize you have friends that love and care about you. What am I supposed to do if you're gone? What is your wife supposed to do if you're gone? What is your sister supposed to do if you're gone? And I think that was my first time that someone had said to me, like, don't be selfish. And then surprisingly, I don't know if it was like my higher power projecting on me supposed to make that happen, but like it did. And I just felt really, really like, you know, that warm feeling you get from drinking. I had felt that in that moment that my buddy talked me out of it. And then the next fucked up thing happened where my car got repossessed because I was late on a payment. And, you know, at that point, I couldn't lie to my wife anymore and say we didn't have fucking any more savings. And, you know, I like she heard like some lights going off and I was just sitting there. I was like, what the fuck's going on? You know, she's like, go wake up, go downstairs. Like somebody might break into the car. And of course, you know, I walk outside and I look and there's a guy with a fucking car in the back of a tow truck. I'm like, oh, fuck. Well, jigs up on this. And then, you know, that started my whole process of deciding I need to go into the program. Because at that point, she said she wanted me to leave, but she wanted to leave all this other shit. There's only a matter of time when I'd take a drink. I finally came into the program. And that's where I got to leave off on that. Leave that one alone.
All right, I'm going to do the last two readings, and then that'll leave you guys with 2 minutes.
Each. Lightning round.
Two. Solid two. Page 41. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time, I had not thought of the consequences at all. I'd commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesized that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again. They had said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more, for what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who said they had a problem, had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power.
All right. 2 minutes, lightning round. Now we're on to how this goes moving forward. All right. So we know we're an alcoholic. We know we have to smash the illusions. how do we get through the next part? Which obviously that's tomorrow. How do we get through? Well, like it says, higher power. You can't get through. Reckon for me personally, it's starting every single day, reminding myself of the first three steps. And then our research department, like I was talking about, to me, the most important person in the room is definitely the newcomer. The second most important person in the room is that person picking up a white chip because they went back out last night. I want to know what happened. I want to know how it is out there. Tell me about it. Is it any better? Has it gotten worse? Da, 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 da. And like I said, that keeps me seated. That keeps me in today. And that keeps me talking with the newcomers for whatever reason it should be or can be. And it keeps me seated because I know my purpose today, because of my relationship with my higher power and these suggestions and my sponsor and home group and all those things that we have in this program. My purpose today is to help that newcomer, whether they are brand new or they're new from last night. Because without the people in these rooms, without the suggestions and the lifeblood of this program, which is that white chip, I guess, you know, we fail. And the unfortunate thing about this thing is that it is progressive disease and it will get worse. It'll get worse for you and it will get worse for me. I know that. And the outcome is death or jail. Was that 2 minutes?
Try to keep it quick. Oh man, 2 minutes. I got a new one I got to try to do. Okay. So I'm gonna leave it like this. I'm glad I'm here. I'm glad I made this program. It's given me a new purpose. I have a higher power that I trust and I talk to every day, multiple times a day, because I'm still fucking insane. It still hasn't gone away. Sorry if my foul language is bothering anybody. That's just how I talk sometimes. The biggest thing I will leave this on is that anyone that hasn't been here long, and even those that have been here for a while, having the squirrely thoughts and thinking about going back out, the only thing you got to do every day is make that first step, admitting you got a problem, that your life's unmanageable, because I have to do that every day. I know I can't go back out. I know how it was beforehand. I wanted to kill myself. I already know if I go back out, man, I am not coming back, because I already know those thoughts are going to come back and I might just fucking end my life. And I don't want that. I like being on the mortal coil now. I really like being alive. Now I have a purpose. I never had one before, and that's to be of service to others and fuck what I think that I need for myself, because what I do for other people is what's going to keep me alive and keep me sober and keep me out of my head. So if you're not been in here long, get a sponsor, work these steps, get some kind of service commitment, even if it's just making coffee. I hopped in the service train and sometimes I don't know how to stop and I have to sleep for a long time because I overdo it, but I'd rather be tired from doing that than be tired because I'm obsessing in my head or I'm thinking I'm out taking a drink and being hungover. Just do it. At least get to the fourth step, because once you get to the fourth step, you'll know if you're in this shit or not. You want to give up before that? Don't do it. Wait till afterward. Feel like you want to give up afterward again? Don't go back out. But I mean, if you feel like you gotta do it, I mean, like, you make your own choices. Do your thing. But hey, I'm here and I had the ability to come and speak tonight. And hopefully some of you guys got something from this. Man, I'm just grateful. There's a lot of people in this room I love. There's people on Zoom that are watching now that I love. And I've seen there's people in other places because of this program I have love for. And I will do just about anything for them, because that's what we're supposed to do as responsible AA members. The biggest thing of an example that I can take from any of this is when my mom passed away, one half of the room was coworkers and family, and the other half was nothing but people from AA. I'm talking about all pews going all the way back. And that is, I don't know if that doesn't say anything. I don't know what else does. And I'm grateful to be here. I'm happy to be alive today, and I love everybody in this room. Thank you for letting me speak.
Thanks, brother John and Devin. All right, we are going to pass the seven tradition basket. Thank you. So you can sign up for email on our website, simpleactions.net. The seven tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seven tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. Are there any announcements, Fisky Pop? Are there any announcements?
We're passing.
For the good of AA, Tyler.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Donald, you have one? Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. And speaking of flyers, there's some yellow, canary yellow. Can we go with canary yellow? Over there on that table. So it's for an event. It's in the end of July. It's a safety in Zoom workshop that we're going to do, not in this room. We're going to do it on Zoom. But what we're asking is maybe on your way out, if you could grab four or five of those flyers and take them back to your group with you. Did I say July this time? Not January? One of those J months. All right. So please take some of these with you. Any other announcements? Civil Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. There's literature available over there. Please see me or any home group member after the meeting if you need a book. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, I will be available here at this table after we close the meeting. Please feel free to talk to me. If you're shy, you can also send an email to info@simpleactions.net. By way of reminder, smokers, please use the butt can provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. And the meeting after the meeting, all are invited and encouraged to join us for fellowship at the meeting after the meeting that will be held at Cafe Stella, across from Bank of America, 22nd in Colonial, right? No? 20 no
it's 25th
it's drive down that way a little bit
19
it's one block before 21st street
next right, to Kogan's
right before the hood
next to Kogan's You ever get thrown out of Kogan's? I've been thrown out of Kogan.
Want to get thrown out of Stella's? Let's get thrown out of Stella's sober,
thoughtlessly overserved. Who's chairing this meeting? I've asked a and I'd like to thank everybody who participated. After the Lord's Prayer, everybody will get a chance to personally thank John and Ben. Please feel free to do that. They were nice enough to come share. And Travis is going to read the last two paragraphs on page 164. Thanks,
Travis. Our book is good. We realize God will come.
Let's circle up.
Cold beer would have messed up everything. Certainly. On the jail.
Our Father, where art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, and we forgive those who trespass against us, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Thine is the kingdom.
Amen. Thank you, brother.